Hello and warm welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, September 6th. I'm joined in the studio today by my lovely co-hosts and comrades, Allison.
Hello.
And Alon is joining us today, a former host of the show back in Vancouver for a while. Thanks for joining us,
Alon. Welcome back, Alon. It's good to have you here.
And Tim.
Hello.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me. Today we have a really special show for you. I'm really excited. You probably saw in the news this week, if you've been watching local newspapers, Canadian papers, there was an NHL player, the National Hockey League, who was showing a decapitated grizzly bear head and a paw, was trophy hunting here. And that is legal, but there is a lot of controversy there. And we're really excited to talk not about that particular person or that event, really, because that was just one of many bears that were killed in this area, but we want to talk about ending bear hunting. So we have a very special guest with us today, or who will be joining us on the phone. He's from Bears Forever. His name is William Housty, and he's involved in the Coastal First Nations coalition group that has come together to ban bear hunting on their territories. So we're going to talk about that very shortly. And also later in the show, we're going to talk to Alon and a guest from Rising Tide, Vancouver Coast Salish Territories, about an upcoming event. What's the name of the event, Alon?
The name of the event is Radical Animals and Ravaged Environments Towards a Common Understanding of Animal Liberation and Environmental Struggles.
Excellent. Yeah. So I want to highlight that and get people out to that event next week. So we'll be talking about that in the second half of the show. Stay tuned.
Yeah, so I have some upcoming events to chat about today, specifically some things that are happening locally. One thing that's happening locally is Stop UBC Animal Research is planning a film screening and a talk that's going to be happening on September 27th. I'll be getting into details about that in a minute, but they are asking supporters and anyone who wants to help, because they are an all-volunteer organization, to attend a planning meeting that they'll be having for this big event. So that's happening on Monday, September 9th at 7 p.m., and you can RSVP to stopubcanimalresearch@gmail.com. That's happening locally in Vancouver. They're a group that is working towards getting animal research stopped at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. So this event that's happening on September the 27th is they're going to be holding a film screening of the film featuring Dr. John Pippin of Maximum Tolerated Dose. It has been screened here before, I believe. I've seen it, and I think it was screened last summer here in Vancouver. They'll be showing that again. They'll be showing what's wrong with animal testing and if it really protects people or does it really protect corporations, really delving into those issues about animal-tested drugs and research. Specifically here in Canada, it's a Canadian film, so that's happening on the 27th at 6 p.m. And then after that, Dr. C. Ray Greek, who is an MD and the author of Sacred Cows and Golden Geese, The Human Cost of Experiments of Animals, will be appearing in person to answer and elaborate on I think it's a video that he's made. It's really well done, and I've seen it on the web. It's called Truisms That Aren't True. It's really great, and I think we actually might be having him coming up on the show that day too, so please stay tuned for that. So that talk will be coming up afterwards on 8 o'clock p.m. That's happening at the Vancouver Public Library. And once again, if you want to get involved in helping organize this event, RSVP to stopubcanimalresearch@gmail.com. And what else do I have for us today? So Campaigns Against Cruelty to Animals, or a local group that goes under the acronym of CATCA, is having an ongoing online auction fundraiser. And if you want to support the work that they're doing there, which is run by Erica Sabellis, we've had her on the show before, you just go to their website at CATCA, that's C-A-T-C-A, CATCAHelpAnimals.org, 100.org. HTML to see the current listings of items that they have there for their auction. You can make your bid. I went on there yesterday and there's a nice selection of artwork and jewelry on there. They're all very affordably priced at their certain prices, so you might be able to get something nice there and help out the cause as well. And she does a lot of great animal advocacy work. Also, what's happening on Friday, September 20th at 4 p.m., this is close to me, sort of where I live. The UBC Activists for Animals Club and VegUBC, which I think is a new group, are hoping a welcome social and raffle at the University of British Columbia. That's happening at the Global Lounge in the Marine Drive Residence Building at UBC. So this is open to anyone. You don't have to be a UBC student to attend. And I think it's just like a welcoming, sort of mingling, get to know people, networking opportunity. You can find out about what UBC Activists for Animals and VegUBC are all about. Meet, mingle, and socialize with other students who love animals and partake in some delicious veg food and social justice and compassionate people like yourself. So if you're interested in attending that event, you can actually RSVP to Wilson Wong. He is the organizer on Facebook. You can email him at activistsforanimals.ubc@gmail.com. That's all I have for now.
Thanks, Allison. Let's hear a song now by a band called Grizzly Bear. This is a song called Fix It. And right after that, we're going to be talking to William Housatee about bears forever and ending the trophy hunt. Again, sung by Grizzly Bear, and called Fix It. And now I think we have someone on the line joining us. So just for some background, so there's 10 First Nation groups have announced a ban on trophy bear hunting on parts of British Columbia's, or what we call British Columbia's coast, last year. And now they're gearing up to actually enforce it during the fall hunting season. It's salmon spawning time, so the bears are out. So they've just announced their new informative website, bearsforever.ca, and they're calling on support for trying to get a public pledge and a whole bunch of signers to help push the provincial government to honor their tribal law. And they've created a stunning 20-minute film called Bear Witness that we'll post on our website, and I highly recommend everyone watch. And that's available at bearsforever.ca. So that's just some background. So now joining us is William Housetee. He has a bachelor degree in natural resource management. He's involved in Bears Forever, and it's a project of Coastal First Nations and the Central Coast First Nations Bear Working Group. Thanks so much for joining us today, William. It's an honor.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. So first, I just wondered if you could just give us a bit of background about the Central Coast First Nations Bear Working Group and how you came to the decision to ban trophy hunting in your member nations.
Well, the Central Coast Bear Working Group is basically an alliance of the four Central Coast tribes, the Heiltsik, the Kitisuu Xexeis, the Nuhalk, and the Wikinuk tribes. Because our territories are so close together, we decided it was time that we'd have a greater voice if we worked together in managing our own bear and habitats and bear populations. Because we were at the front lines of this work, Coastal First Nations, who represents all the nations here in the Great Bear Rainforest, have given us the authority to take on a lot of the activity around trophy hunting. For years and years, we've had issues with hunters being in our territory and leaving behind carcasses and just performing really inhumane activity in our areas. And we just reached the point where we just feel a need that we have to bring this to an end.
That's great. Thanks for filling us in. I see that that it's non-residents and also residents who are there killing bears. Would you say there's a difference in like, are residents actually being more humane about it, or is it mostly just kind of outsiders coming in and not showing respect to the land?
No, I think it's, we're looking at it in terms of, you know, hunter's a hunter, whether they have a tag or not, or whether they're doing it illegally. I mean, it's, overall, it's inhumane activity is our point. And, mm-hmm. you know, we have an average of 94 to 95 grizzlies and blacks combined being taken from the Great Bear Rainforest a year. And when you think about the place that these bears hold in these ecosystems on the coast here, it's crazy to think that many bears are being taken for sport. So, you know, it's very difficult for us to fathom that this is happening in the Great Bear Rainforest, a protected area. You know, it's kind of ironic that these bears are being killed in an area that was named after the bears.
Yeah, it's my understanding that some of the area, it is actually illegal totally to hunt bears. Is that right? Like, I read that close to 60% of that area, it's already banned. It's just the other 40% that you're looking to further protect?
Well, there are areas within the Great Bear Rainforest that are, there is a ban on trophy hunting, and those are the areas that are home to the spirit bear, which are completely illegal to hunt. But we're looking for a complete ban on this hunt because of how inhumane it is for this to be happening at this day and age. It just seems so sad that we're still doing things like this here in the year 2013.
And so now you've announced this law, this movement, and you're looking for public support, and now I guess the hunt is going to be starting, and there's going to be some hunters out there. What are you going to do about hunters that you find in that area?
Yeah, that's correct. Hunting started in certain areas up here on September 1st. In my area here in the Heiltsik, it starts September 10th, so we're preparing to have our people on the ground to monitor that. At this point, you know, we did issue the ban last year. We are again continuing on with the ban here in 2013. At this point, you know, we're We're planning on being in the field in these areas where we know the hunters will be. We'll try and inform the hunters, if they're there, of our ban and the intent behind it. And that's all we can do at this point. And we've known from past experience that our presence alone has deterred hunters. So we're hoping that that'll continue and help us to enforce this ban. Because I think this issue is bigger than just a First Nations issue now. It's really a provincial issue, it's a Canadian issue, and just the human issue of this hunt happening.
William, you're talking about how inhumane the hunt is, and maybe perhaps you can paint a picture for our listeners exactly what you mean by that. This is simply sport hunting. What are the hunters doing with the bears after they kill them?
So what's happening is, and the example I'll use is what happened this May in the Kwantlen Estuary when we had Clayton Stoner, who was came in and shot a bear only meters from our technicians who were on the ground there. Shot the bear three times, cut off the skin, he decapitated the bear, took the head, cut off the paws, and basically left the rest of the carcass to just rot in the middle of the estuary. So, I mean, these hunters are taking only what they need, which is usually the skin and the skull and the paws, and they're leaving the rest of the meat and the body to just disintegrate into nature, and it's quite a grotesque thing to come across when you're walking in these beautiful landscapes, and right. And it deters other bears from using this these places, because if you go into a lot of these places in the spring, the places where the hunters are hunting are prime areas for feeding for the bears when they first come out of their den. So if you shoot a bear and leave the carcass there, a lot of the other bears will be deterred and won't even come around, and they're losing out on their food source. So it's just a really grotesque activity.
I wonder if I can ask you some questions about, or a question about sovereignty. Last Tuesday, Steve Thompson, the BC Minister of Forests and Lands, said that, as we did last fall, we ask that the coastal First Nations respect the province's authority over the harvest. So clearly there's issues around a government which has a colonial history, obviously not respecting First Nations bans on these kind of areas. So I wonder if you can actually talk about what this means from an anti-colonial perspective for the province to actually not be following through with these bans.
Well, Minister Thompson has stated year in, year out that he wishes, he wants the First Nations to respect their authority over the management of this hunt. On the same token, we're asking Minister Thompson and the government to respect our laws, because our traditional laws have been enacted and practiced here in our territory for thousands of years before Canadian law came around. So, you know, we're only standing up for the bears and for ourselves in this. And I think for them to request us to respect their law, I think they have to come down to earth and respect our laws at the same point, so we can find some common ground on this and really shake out what how this really is. I mean, we've seen back in 2008, we had 76% of British Columbians opposed the bear hunt. Now here we are 5 years later, and we're up to 87% of British Columbians who oppose the bear hunt. So, you know, there's a big shift in movement in the mindset of British Columbians that I think we really need to listen to, because these are the people that are voting, people like Christy Clark and Minister Thompson in other positions. So I think it's really important that they come down to earth and listen to what the people are telling them.
And now you have science on your side. I guess they were saying, we have good science on this. There's plenty of bears out there. We've set the numbers and we know what we're talking about. But now you've created this. Can you tell us about the scientific campaign and how you're fighting back with that?
Well, what we've done is we scrutinized the methods of the government and their science, their sound science, as they call it, and realized that a lot of their numbers would come from a computer and modeling that come out of Victoria that we feel is, you know, not the greatest method. So we started our own sort of project here on the Central Coast. All of the Central Coast nations are involved in this project, as well as Chris Dermont and Rain Coast Society. We're all doing this using the same sort of methods, collecting bear hair invasively through barbed wire snares, and we're finding out information about individual bears, and we're getting to know populations of bears, getting to know more about where they're moving between the territories and how these bears are levels, their population levels are increasing and decreasing with things like salmon population as they're up and down. So, I mean, our science is really on the ground. It's done from within our communities, and it's done collectively all in the same way. And I think we're really knowing more about the bear population here on the Central Coast and the Great Bear Rainforest. And I think, you know, the numbers that we're finding aren't as high as the province's numbers. And I think that's because we're on the ground and they're in the computer.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question, which is, how did the collaboration with the students or at the University of Victoria come about? That's an interesting collaboration.
Well, up in our territory here, there's a big pressure from lots of academic institutions to do different science work up here. One of the institutions, as you said, was the University of Victoria, and through Chris Dermont, who's been doing work in this area for a long time. So through protocol agreements with the individual communities, University of Victoria and Chris Dermont were able to come to terms and be able to decide on how they wanted to proceed with a science project that would not only obtain data for UVic, but would also come up with great data for the communities that help make management decisions like this. So it's really a collective agreement that we have amongst the nations and amongst the universities that are here to support some of the initiatives that are ongoing here.
Thank you. And I'm wondering if you can tell us now about what role bears play in your cultural heritage, and, you know, why you're drawn to this particular cause, and how bears are viewed up there. I'm guessing they don't have a history of being eaten that much. What role have they played?
Well, bears are very significant in the culture of the coastal First Nations here. You know, they're a clan symbol. All of the First Nations here hold the bear in very high regard, a very high amount of respect for the bear. It's involved in a lot of our ceremonies. For thousands of years prior to contact, we lived out in grizzly bear habitat with them, coexisted with them. We have a long history of living with them and sharing food sources with them, like the salmon. So there's, you know, our people really hold the bear in high regard and really have a deep respect for them and their existence, because the bears themselves are a really good indicator of how healthy our land is here. If the bears are here, you know that you're living in a healthy place. So the bears are really telling us a lot of things just by having them here. So, you know, we have that relationship with them, that connection with them that I think is really deep and tells a lot about our relationship with them. And that's really where we're coming from when we put this ban on the trophy hunt, is because, you know, the way they treat these bears, shooting them and taking parts of them and leaving the rest of them to rot in the estuaries, there's nothing respectful about that to the bear. There's no reverence in that. It's all just kind of a sick game that, you know, we just don't see as being proper here.
Now, of course, for many folks who are not indigenous or, in fact, settlers in this land and who participate in animal liberation, this issue seems like an issue of animal liberation. But as you've been saying, it's so much more than that. It's about defense of the land. It's about defense of traditional territories. So I wonder, how do you think of the struggle? Because when we talk to many settlers about these issues, for them, it's an animal rights issue, but it's clearly not just an animal rights issue.
Yeah, no, this is an issue it's an animal rights issue. You know, you look at the way the bears are treated, the way when they're shot and left to just kind of disintegrate. You know, for us as First Nations, it's another stumbling block in trying to work with the government, colonial issues. So it goes deeper than just an animal rights issue. They're all important issues that we think need to be addressed. That's why we're making a big push towards trying to have all this trophy hunt banned, so that we can, have a stepping stone into the times that we live in here. You know, we're long past the time when we're trophy hunting and things like that. You know, our people, our society, not just First Nations, everybody has come so far, it's hard to fathom how this is still happening.
And have you received any support from folks who identify themselves as animal liberation activists on these issues?
I to tell you the truth, you know, we've received support from so many different organizations, so many different people, and so many different levels. It's been overwhelming. So yes, we continue to look for that support and build a big case to push to have this hunt banned.
If I could, we don't have that much time, but I'm just curious kind of your personal feelings on the animal rights movement or animal liberation. We here at Animal Voices believe that, you know, animals are not our property to use and exploit. Do you have feelings about that movement, or do you feel that there's like a natural overlap between issues you're working for and ones that we're working for?
Well, no, I completely agree with you that, you know, animals are, you know, deserve to be treated properly. They deserve to be wild. They, you know, they're not ours to control. Coming from a background that I do, where myself and my family do harvest animals for food, like black-tailed deer and seals and sea lions and such, you know, we do it in a respectful way. We don't do it in a way that we're making the animals suffer, and we're not over-harvesting them. We're doing it in a respectful way and according to our cultural practices. But I completely agree with you that, you know, these animals really need to be treated with respect and looked at as almost like human beings ourselves.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. I don't see much difference. I see them as non-human animal nations, not just species that are under humans.
I can throw in a quick comment on that. You know, in our culture up here, you know, every living animal has a spirit, and in times before, long before us, those spirits had the ability to be humans and transform back and forth and go in between these two different worlds. So the respect level that we have for all animals here is very great because of that, because we're one with all of the animals here. Our connection to the animals is still very, very strong, and we don't forget about how the place that they hold in our history and even in the present.
So for folks who actually do care about animal liberation and care about these issues, but perhaps don't have so much of a perspective around anti-colonial struggles, what would you say to folks to become more engaged in these kind of campaigns and actually include a decolonial perspective in their activism?
Well, I mean, it's really important to educate yourself. You know, there's so many things that we can do to educate ourselves on all lots of different levels. I mean, I would advise people, you know, to use our campaign as an example, bearsforever.ca. You can go on that website and learn a lot about what we're doing. And I'm sure there's other websites and pamphlets and people out there that can inform you on different movements that are really educational. That, you know, because if we're not educated on a topic, how are we supposed to understand and be able to support something fully? So I think that's the most important thing, is to educate people on the issue.
Yeah, we've certainly worked a lot on that in the past year, and with Elon's help as well. Thanks, Elon, for sending some shows that show those interconnected issues and how we all relate.
Yeah, and you said, again, bearsforever.ca. There's lots of information there. Definitely check out the Bear Witness video. It's amazing production value, an amazing website. And I really wish the best to your campaign. There's a pledge on your website where people can make a pledge of their support, which, polls show that it's about 90%. So hoping that the provincial government gets the message and makes it into official law. Thanks so much for your time today, William.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure.
Hi, I'm Gunnar Giel Sullivan.
And I'm Woody Morrison.
Join us every Monday from 1 to 2:30 p.m.
On When Spirit Whispers, the First Nations program,
we cover truth and reconciliation,
art, music, politics, current and cultural events.
Give us a call, 604-684-7561. Don't forget to join us every Monday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. on When Spirit Whispers.
And you are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. This is Animal Voices, your weekly animal-related radio show. And I've got some news for you. lots of animal activism news this week. I start with... Sorry?
Hi.
Hi. I start with a news item from Australia's ABC Landline News. They reported that the Animal Liberation Group, which is closely connected to the Animal Justice Party in Australia, has invested 14,000 Australian dollar into a drone and equipped it with a very high-tech HD video camera to investigate farms in Australia. And the first farm they investigated was a chicken farm, which claims to be a free-range chicken farm. So they flew the drone up into the air and didn't see any chickens outside. And the farmer later said, they were all just happened to be inside that day because something like they had to be treated for something, but usually he would let them out. But obviously this is a really good, a really interesting development, I think. I think it's a good reaction. I remember we reported a few weeks ago that a journalist from National Geographic got arrested for flying over a farm and taking picture of it. So now having a drone to fly next to a farm and not go into their airspace and not be trespassing and still investigating, yeah. I think it's a really interesting development.
I think it's a very interesting tactic. We did an interview several months ago with a Blackfish organization who are currently utilizing drones in the Mediterranean Sea, because how else are you going to get into the sea and see what kind of illegal fishing practices are happening there? You use a drone.
Of
so I think that's interesting.
But it's obviously really important to point out that when it comes to issues on land, that of course the governments of many of these countries, like in the US and Canada, I'm not so sure about Australian laws, but they have ad gag laws where you simply cannot film. So it's very clear in the way in which states actually try limit out the amount of undercover information that can actually come out from these places and actually can show the immense brutality that goes on in these farms.
Yeah. Okay, some other news. There was a report in the New York Times and in the UK Guardian that 1,150 chickens got rescued in California. They were chickens from egg-laying battery, and they are about 2 years old, so they are spent in industrial farming terms, because they don't lay enough eggs anymore, although natural life for the chicken would be they would live at least 2 to 4 years more. So they got liberated, interestingly enough, with the collaboration or with the approval of the farm where the chickens used to live. But they needed to find a place for the chickens to live, so they... an anonymous donor provided enough funding, in $50,000 in total, to rent an airplane to move these chickens overnight to a sanctuary in New York.
Wow.
I think that's pretty amazing.
Do you know what sanctuary took them? I read
Animal
about
Place.
That's in California.
No, oh, yeah. Animal Place is the one who organized the rescue.
Oh.
And they took them...
Just wondering.
And what would normally happen to them is they would be probably gassed.
That's right. Yeah.
Killed.
No, I don't know where they took them. Sorry.
But all the way to New York. Wow. They can fly.
Yeah.
Their wings must be tired.
So
so the other news article is that Tyler Lang and Kevin Olaf are two Los Angeles animal rights activists who were arrested in rural Illinois for possession of burglary tools. After a traffic stop in which they refused to consent to a police search, their car was searched anyway, and inside police allege that they found wire cutters and camo clothing. Of course, these are claimed to be burglary tools intended to be used in a crime, and arrested Kevin and Tyler. They're held on felony charges which carry up to 3 years in prison, and they've remained in jail since their arrest on August 15th. Of course, there's no evidence linking them to any crime or intended crime, merely that they had these tools in their cars. The updates, however, are that while they were originally arrested on August 14th, and there was a really big call out to send them books and food, money for food that they can buy, vegan food, the jail has now sent out a message 2 days ago that they're not allowed to receive books anymore, and they're no longer allowed to receive money to actually receive vegan food. So one of the things that you can do, of course, is actually call the police station and say this is, first of all, illegal what they're doing, and it's completely inhumane. It's worth mentioning that in prison, food such as having vegan food is seen as a privilege, not a right. So if you're a vegan, they don't actually care whether
you receive. And it's a privilege to receive books as well, so to keep your sanity. I didn't realize of that. Course. I thought that was a basic human right that was afforded in prisons.
So one of the things you can do is call the jail at 309-467-2116. And you can actually complain about this, or you can actually call Sheriff James Pearsall at 309-467-2375. And we know that phone calls do achieve results, and many small battles like these have been won for prisoners through phone calls from the outside. And so Kevin and Tyler send you their thanks.
Thanks for that, Elon. I wanted to quickly mention, I think we can maybe skip the song, I'm not sure, but I wanted to mention also there was a big mink and fox liberation in a rural Ontario town called Renton, and that was the first one that was like kind of announced or acknowledged by the Fur Council of Canada. And interesting about that particular one, well, first of all, there was 420 mink and about 80 fox, said the farm, that were released from their cages at night, and the Animal Liberation Front took responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. And the Fur Council of Canada called it terrorism. And I think that's very common language in the U.S., but not so much in Canada. And that's why this is notable news. So
we have some mink farms in Canada, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And because I know overall there aren't very many in the United States. I remember one well-known activist saying that the mink fur industry could be shut down overnight if people who grouped together and went to the 3 or 5 mink farms across the states and liberated all the mink. And that would be it. It would be done for. So I know they're not very common, and I think we have fewer here in Canada.
I think the sad thing for this mink farm is, though, that most of the minks have been caught again. And what I find a bit shocking is that it was the Ministry of Natural Resources that has organized and financed the hunt for the minks with baited live traps as primary means of capture. So the latest news I read from Sun News was that only they captured all but 15 mink and 20 fox from that farm, which is a bit sad, I find.
So it's always worth pointing out that when the governments are involved in these kind of actions, it may be worth considering taking extra legal alternatives where lobbying or where petitioning the state itself is not effective, because the state itself is involved in these kind of actions.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we have an interview lined up. So we're talking to, let me see here. Oh, okay. Well, why aren't ecological protection movements more entwined with struggles to end animal oppression? Aren't we all fighting the same fight after all? Some local activists seek to facilitate a community dialogue about these issues at an event upcoming next Thursday, September 12th, called Radical Animals and Ravaged Environments, A New Understanding for a Common Struggle. So we have someone joining us, well, Elon in the studio, who's a co-organizer of that event on behalf of the Black Pawprint Collective. And Fletch is joining us online. He's from Rising Tide, Vancouver Coast Salish Territories. Thanks for joining us today, Fletch.
Hi, Alyssa. It's my pleasure.
So let's talk first about, I'll just ask you if you can introduce the Rising Tide and explain a bit about how you came to be involved in organizing this event.
Absolutely. So Rising Tide is a radical environmental organization that does confronts climate justice issues, and they predominantly work from a anti-colonial and a anti-capitalist perspective. So that immediately intrigued me when I joined the collective. I don't know, probably 6 months ago now. They do all sorts of fantastic work, but the thing that really intrigued me was their analysis of the interconnectedness between different struggles through helping indigenous people keep sovereignty over their land and preventing them from having their land exploited by extraction companies, and then, you know, even into the city with gentrification issues, and just across the board. I really was happy to see this group covering all sorts of major problems we're dealing with in our culture right now.
And of course, Fletch, it's worth pointing out that other mainstream environmental groups in Vancouver or in Canada in general, such as Greenpeace, have had a notorious track record of not taking into account Indigenous land claims or Indigenous sovereignty issues. So it's really important to point out that Rising Tide is very unique in the fact that anti-colonial struggles is at the forefront of this organizing.
Yes, absolutely. I had a lot of trouble in the past kind of trying to align my politics with different environmental groups, finding that there was often a lot of embedded racism, almost unintentionally, inside of those organizations. I also found it within sort of animal welfare and animal rights organizations too. So it was really, really nice to see a group that did a lot of work around all sorts of different issues, specifically around decolonization and anti-colonial issues, though.
So just to kind of go back to sort of the broader picture, just wondering, when thinking about why there hasn't been more overlap in terms of animal rights struggles particularly and ecological protection, one thing that comes to mind is that ecological protection lens kind of seems to view animals as whole species, so that in effect justifies killing certain numbers of animals as long as the whole population isn't significantly harmed. What are your thoughts on this paradigm difference or others?
Well, I've kind of struggled with this because I certainly want to see many different animals living a wonderful and fulfilling life in the wild, and so I've specifically kind of been confronted with this issue of the wolf call up north. It's happening across the Pacific Northwest, kind of statewide and province-wide, and it's really problematic for me. And so I kind of spent some time looking into it. And I noticed that the BC government was promoting the wolf call because they were really concerned about the caribou population up north. And so my immediate response was like, okay, so what's really up here? So I spent a bit of time looking into it and found some studies that had been done by a few different independent groups, and they had found that the caribou were quite likely dying because of the migration paths and their water supplies being destroyed by the tar sands. And so I feel like that there is kind of the way that these issues are being linked are kind of, there's kind of a smokescreen that exists there, and it needs to be kind of looked into a little bit more. As far as looking at individual issues of specific animals, who gets to live and who doesn't get to live, that's a really tough decision, and I don't know how to tackle that, but I do feel like quite often it's not as cut and dry as that.
Did you have a response, Elon? Something to add?
No, I think that's totally accurate what Fletch said.
Okay, thanks. So I want to talk now about how the roots of climate change are linked to the root causes of non-human animal oppression. Just trying to link these two issues. You had said your group is anti-colonial. Can we describe a bit more about that and how decolonization is a concept and a practice that can link both? Can you just kind of expand on that?
So specifically, it is not my... It's not on me to completely establish the decolonization process, and I don't know what will fix our mistakes and what won't. I've intentionally tried to take the lead, not take the lead, but, you know, learn from some different Indigenous groups about what is really important to them. And I think for them, it really means, like, spending more time on the land and kind of removing themselves from the colonial culture that has completely taken over their lives. And so for different groups, it means you know, setting up blockades, and it means stopping extraction companies from coming in and trying to destroy the land that they're trying to subsist off of. And I think there's a really, really close parallel between that and the wild animals that are living out on those lands. So, you know, you have the Wet'suwet'en Nation or the Unist'ot'en people on the Wet'suwet'en traditional territory up north that are blocking seven different pipelines, and they are blocking them in an effort to prevent the pipelines running through the Maurice River, which is spawning grounds for the salmon that live up there and is the natural habitat for the moose up there. And so they're doing their absolute best to prevent that. And I think that by them decolonizing themselves and helping settlers decolonize themselves, they in effect will also help to let the animals subsist on those lands that need to exist. As far as, like, specifically helping settlers decolonize, it's a really difficult process, and I don't think the onus is on the Indigenous people that live there or anywhere, whether it's in the metropolis or it's out on the land. But it is difficult for us to figure out how to do that, so we do often have to talk to them. And I think that one of the most important things is just to listen to the stories they have and understand and respect everything that they have, and help them rebuild their territories and rebuild all their traditions that they have lost. And if we can do that, then I think we're on a good start.
Elon, can you say a few words about how what decolonization process means to you and how it's important to both the earth and animals?
I mean, obviously, it's a really tricky question, as Fletch rightly points out, and I'm not entirely sure what it does mean to me. I mean, part of it is obviously a question of solidarity, and I think, like William said, being in solidarity and in support with groups such as the First Nations communities that are banning the trophy hunt up north is obviously an instance where, you know, for me as a settler, I can actually engage in these processes and actually say, well, look, it's clearly an animal liberation issue, but it's so much more than that. It's also about protecting and respecting Indigenous territories, where in British Columbia, it's unceded. And this is something that we need to always emphasize, that in BC, the government is, by its own laws, illegal, because there have been no treaties here and there's been no agreements between the British government that came in and obviously colonized the territories and the First Nations people that live here. So part of it for me is, of course, being in support with First Nations communities that are struggling to defend the land. And we also have to realize that defending the land always means defending the people that live on that land, which is both humans and non-humans. And so this is where animal liberation is so clearly connected with a decolonial project to actually undermine colonial laws that usurped sovereignty from First Nations communities.
Thanks. So just to go further, because we have a bit more time, besides the obvious fact that we all need clean air to breathe and water to drink and land to house us, why should those engaged in the work of anti-oppression of non-human animals also work to fight environmental injustice? What sort of call to action can you do you want to share?
I think that regarding folks that are deeply involved in anti-oppression work for animals and social justice issues, I mean, for me, it's really hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. I just, they seem so paralleled with each other, and I think that most levels of oppression are essentially like enabling one another. So if you do not tackle one issue, you will not be able to deal with the other. And I think that it just requires movement building among those different groups. So whether it requires, you know, people in the downtown east side working really hard not so much the individuals themselves, but people that are helping to organize, and the individuals helping people that are doing work around, wild animals being rescued and people trying to save their land base. I think that if they all start kind of working together, we have a broader movement that will push towards a more anti-capitalist and anti-colonial society, which is something that I really think we need to work towards.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just point out one group that I know of that's bringing a whole bunch of groups together and trying to do this intersectional analysis, environment and prisoner justice and feminism and all that, Resistance Ecology, who just had their first conference, mm-hmm. and who just organized really last year, came together with a new mandate and a new name, forming from past groups. But yeah, Rising Tide was involved in organizing down there in Portland, was involved in organizing the Resistance Ecology Conference this earlier this summer, and look forward to more of that
We had a great interview on the show that you did, Alyssa, that was just fantastic, that people should check out if they can on our website, animalvoices.org, Resistance Ecology. Just look that up.
Great. So if I can just say a small summary about the event itself.
Yeah.
The event will be on Thursday, September 12th at what used to be known as the Rhizome Cafe, but is now no longer the Rhizome Cafe. Essentially, as you've heard, it's a really complicated issue how we tackle all these connected struggles together. So as part of this event, I will be speaking on behalf of the Back Paw Print Collective, giving a new understanding of what it means to engage in veganism and animal rights as a form of solidarity. Comrade Black, who's an activist working with Profane Existence, which is a resource group for the worldwide activist punk community, and he's also an activist with the former Shack Canada. He'll be talking about also animals and non-human animals in the environment, along with Fletch, but they'll both be tackling the issue from a different perspective. On the one hand, we'll be hearing what it means to look at the environment from an animal liberation perspective, and similarly, we'll be hearing what it looks at what it means to engage in animal liberation from an environmental perspective. And of course, we'll have other speakers there as well, alongside Fletch.
And what are your hopes for this event? What's your vision?
Ostensibly, talking for myself from an animal liberation perspective, it would be really, really great if other folks in the animal rights, animal welfare, animal liberation community can engage in environmental struggles and mm-hmm. all these other issues that we've been talking about. We often hear how animal rights tend to be very single issue, very narrowly focused. I can't speak for Fletch, so maybe he wants to tell us what he hopes to kind of get out of this event from a Rising Tide perspective.
So I would agree. I think it's really important that we help people see the interconnectedness of all of these different struggles. And I feel like I'm organizing with a lot of amazing and great environmentalists and some people who are animal liberation folks. And I would really like to see kind of both groups start to collaborate a lot closer with each other, as well as any other sort of social justice organizations. And so that's just what would be beautiful to me. I want to see those groups all working together as one and to make some great things happen.
And for folks who are really interested in these issues and maybe cannot make it out to the event next Thursday, obviously Rising Tide is looking for more people to work with and to volunteer. If somebody's interested in actually organizing around these issues, Fletch, how can they get involved with Rising Tide?
You can go to our website, which is risingtide604.org, I believe. If that's not correct, if you Google it, something similar will pop up. And you can, every third weekend, we meet every Sunday, and every third weekend is a open meeting for new members, and you can come in, and we kind of give you a rundown of how we'd like to see things work, and if this interests you, then you're welcome to the group. If you look on our Facebook page, it usually posts when our next open meeting is, and they are monthly, so please join us.
And of course, no experience is necessary, just a passion for social justice.
Absolutely, yes.
Thanks for joining us, Fletch. I look forward to meeting you at the event next week.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
You do have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Please join us on next week's show. Cynthia will be back and she'll be producing, and we'll be presenting an interview with Matt Ellerbeck on salamanders. Matt has been on the show before to speak about snakes and
piranhas.
He also advocates for scorpions. He's always advocating for those animals that really there's no one else speaking out for. So I'm really looking forward to having him back. We here at the Animal Voices show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and you can join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or on email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And also please check out our website, animalvoices.org, where you can download our past shows on. I just wanted to mention one more quick event. We talked about this a little bit last week. Saturday, October the 5th at 11 a.m., we are participating in Farm Sanctuary's Walk for Farm Animals, which is happening in Vancouver on that day downtown. And I just wanted to mention, we had talked about this a bit last week. This is a great event to raise money for farmed animals who are rescued and sent to the Farm Animal Sanctuary's three shelters in the United States. It's just a wonderful organization. Animal Voices has started a fundraising group, and anyone's welcome to join it. So if you want to be part of our group, we will have us Animal Voices hosts there participating. You can just go to walkforfarmanimals.org, click on Join a Team, find the Vancouver event there. When you register, just click on the Animal Voices radio show team to join us, and you're set. You can be part of our fundraising group, and our goal is to raise $1,000. We are going to be closing the show with a song. What's the song?
The song is Animal Liberation by Los Fastidios, and stay tuned for Radio Eco Chalk with Alex Smith.
Thanks so much for listening to Animal Voices today. Remember to be kind to the animals.
Per gli animali non esiste alcun diritto.
Fight for animals!
Fight!
Fight for animals!
Fight! Io non posso più restare indifferente alla violenza sul mondo animale in nome della scienza. Basta i vostri esperimenti, più diritti agli animali. Apriremo quelle gabbie vili e co-criminali.
Animal liberation, animal liberation, animal liberation world.
Milioni di animali catturati ogni giorno per il business della moda, dell'industria e dei suoi boia.
Fight for animals,
fight.
Fight for animals,
fight. Il tuo diritto all'eleganza non può certo prevalere sul diritto di sopravvivenza.